This is KUOW's Week in Review. Welcome to Friday. I'm Bill Radke. I'd love to hear from you on email, record@kuow.org. Also reading your comments on Twitter. We are at KUOW. And today I'm with Ron Sims, former King County Executive, former Deputy Secretary at HUD in the Obama administration. Welcome back, Ron. We'll get your microphone on. Sydney Brownstone, reporter at The Stranger. Hi there.
Hey.
Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Bill.
So, on the Week in Review today, our first conversation is going to be about how to respond to the Trump administration and to white nationalists. Last weekend in Seattle, a right-wing group called Patriot Prayer rallied at Westlake Center. The organizer, Joey Gibson, told his followers before the rally not to engage in any physical fighting. On stage, he denounced the Ku Klux Klan and the white supremacist violence in Charlottesville. He invited counter-protesters to address the crowd, and he said he was not in Seattle to instigate violence.
I mean, I am an instigator because I go into these liberal areas and I say my name is Joey Gibson, and I love America, and I love everything about it. I love freedom, and I'm polite, and I'm respectful. I do not ever cuss at them, and I'm not ever hateful towards them. If we can't be free to talk and to have a conversation and to have a debate, that's an attack on free speech. And the only way we can do that is to begin to love people. We don't have to like someone. There's a lot of people who annoy the crap out of me who I love to death, okay? But we can focus on love and focus on being good people and appreciate other people's opinions and stop getting triggered so much. And I believe that is the key. That is the purpose of political correctness, so that we don't talk, so that we don't exchange our different ideas. Because when we talk, and we talk about differences of opinion, both people, if they're open, they both grow. They don't necessarily agree with each other, but they grow.
Counter-protesters held their own event in Denny Park, calling it Solidarity Against Hate. This woman identified herself as Blossom. She said the violence in Virginia inspired her to show up.
I don't want Nazis to gain a foothold in the U.S. I think that if we don't fight against them, then they're going to think that it's okay for them to be Nazis, and that's not what I want for this country. That's not what I want for the world.
Not everyone was as calm as Blossom and Gibson. There were racist slogans and air horns and screaming and scuffling. Seattle police largely kept the two groups apart, sometimes with pepper spray. Is the counter-protesting helpful? Did I just make a false equivalence? On Saturday Night Live, Tina Fey said white nationalists should just be ignored.
I would urge people this Saturday, instead of participating in the screaming matches and potential violence, find a local business you support, maybe a Jewish-run bakery or an African-American-run bakery. Order a cake with the American flag on it, like this one, and just eat it, Colin.
She tore into that sheet cake while mocking Trump and Ann Coulter and Paul Ryan and neo-Nazis, and this was her conclusion.
I really want to say, to encourage all good, sane Americans to treat these rallies this weekend like the opening of a thoughtful movie with two female leads. Don't show up. Let these morons scream into the empty air. I love you, Charlottesville, and as Thomas Jefferson once said, who's that hot light-skinned girl over by the butter churn?
Tina Fey!
Confront, ridicule, ignore. Ron Sims, when the next right-wing rally hits Seattle, and it will, what will you do?
I'll ignore them. You know, it's really interesting. I don't mind silent protest, because that's very powerful, too, for people just to go. You're not going to drown them out. There's no reason to get in an argument. But sometimes if you don't see anybody protesting, the assumption is that the community is acquiescing and agreeing with what's being said. So I don't mind having a lot of people hold signs, and I was called, nothing is more powerful at times than a silent protest where you're just holding up the signs, letting the person know that they're not welcome. I believe in free speech. It absolutely is essential. And silent protest with hundreds or thousands of people around the person who is saying things you disagree with proves to be a very, very powerful statement.
Sydney, you agree? The silent statement?
I think there should always be some sort of confrontation, and it's disturbing to me to hear so many people celebrating Tina Fey's statement, because as someone who is a non-Jew and who is white without any skin in the game, I would tell Tina Fey and people who are endorsing that idea is that we've seen before what happens when we ignore white nationalism and what happens when we ignore an open display of racism in our streets. What's that Edmund Burke quote? All that's necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. So, I think there should always be some form of protest from people. And one of the most effective displays of protest I've ever seen, there's been this video floating around the internet about this German town that when they had a neo-Nazi rally, they decided to raise money for an anti-extremist organization by... for every number of steps the neo-Nazis walked, they contributed $1. And I just thought that was a perfect way to ridicule them and confront them at the same time. They even had banners up on the streets saying, like, way to go, keep going, you know, keep marching, you're raising more money. So I thought that was incredibly effective. But I don't think we should celebrate doing nothing.
Okay, so I want to sort that out a little bit. So the way to go, neo-Nazis, every step helps. Wait, That is nonviolent. It's also a kind of mocking. But you're putting the Tina Fey don't show up and ridiculing in a different category. Help me out.
Well, yeah. One way is directly confronting the Nazis and raising money for an anti-extremist organization and, you know, making a very public show of solidarity against them. And the other one is staying home and eating sheet cake and doing nothing.
It's not the mocking you mind. It's go, as Ron is saying, go, be there, confront. Without violence.
Confront without violence. It's the silent acquiescence that I mind.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely crucial. Confrontation is, I think, essential. How you confront is important, because if you confront statements that glorify violence with actual violence, then you start to create sympathies for the people who, you know, appear to be under attack. And it gives them publicity and feeds their egos and their attempts to recruit more people. Showing up either in silent protest or a combination of silent protest and humor is really effective. But the main thing is you've got to show up. Whatever the form of extremism is, it needs to be confronted. As Ron pointed out, if you don't show up at all, it looks like acquiescence or apathy or both.
No, I agree. When I was a kid... this is a long time ago. We had a major retailer that only employed African Americans in the warehouse, never retail, on the basis that his white customers did not want to take change from the hands of a black person. So my parents led a series of demonstrations, and one of them I got spit on by this man. And I chased him. I was really going to whack him with the sign. And my father grabbed me and said, never lower yourself again in front of me. I'll never forget that. That it took courage and discipline not to hit the person who demeaned you. And I never forgot that, saying that the most powerful statement is not to let them win. This person was trying to provoke me. Don't let them win, which I would say being present, holding those signs, literally you're ignoring them in many respects, but you got to make a powerful statement that we're different than they are.
Yeah, the most interesting... demonstration I ever participated in was led by a group of Catholic sisters in downtown. I'm sure Ron saw them. They used to go down on a certain day of every month, and they would stand silently and bear witness to victims of human trafficking and other kinds of exploitation. And it was that experience as much as anything that motivated me to work on the human trafficking issue. I thought it was incredibly powerful. It was also extremely dignified, and by approaching the issue in a dignified way, they gave dignity to the issue.
Yep.
If there'd been a group of people standing there screaming and yelling and trying to disrupt everyone around them, they wouldn't have gained the kind of sympathy or awareness that they achieved with that very different approach they took.
Well, screaming was a part of the confrontation. There are many types in Seattle this weekend. Sydney, what do you think of the showing up and red-faced, you know, in-your-face yelling?
I'd rather neo-Nazis be scared in America than Jews or black people or Latinos or Muslims, so I don't mind screaming at Nazis. I'll scream all day long.
Are they scared by that?
They should be.
Yeah, well, I wonder what you think of the idea that here's this guy, Joey Gibson, who comes to Seattle. Obviously, he knows that he's going to be confronted. And there, I'm seeing people say that that this is exactly what we want. Is this confrontation, so that you have Donald Trump saying, Look at the alt-left swinging clubs. And so that the average person is, who's maybe not paying that much attention, what they see is screaming and, in their mind, clubs on both sides, and they can write everybody off.
If you are not able to distinguish the difference between a group of white nationalists wearing swastikas marching down the streets of a University of Virginia campus and the people who came to show up and protest them, you are part of the problem. Whataboutism is a classic Donald Trump strategy. But that's what he was always going to do. People will always make false equivalencies.
And what about the effect in the public mind? Do you think the public is moved one way or the other? Not in Seattle, but nationwide. What do you think the effect has been on public opinion?
Public opinion? I mean, I think we are seeing a lot of people come out and say that this is not okay, that white nationalism is not okay. We've seen Republicans come out and say this is not okay, which is kind of ironic because these sympathies have been nurtured for quite a long time in the party and in Donald Trump, and Jews and ethnic and religious minorities have been saying this for a long time. I hate to say we told you so, but we told you so.
Because Steve Bannon this week, who, by the way, broke today that he's leaving the White House. Steve Bannon said, keep talking about racism, left. I love it. You're talking about racism and we win. I just want to know what do we think of that, of Bannon's assessment?
It's garbage. We should be talking about racism. We should be talking about white nationalism. We should be identifying these ideologies. We should be identifying supporters of them so we know how to counteract them. I think that we should be saying loud and clear that white identity or white nationalism is not an ideology of love or compassion, because a white identity is not real. Its only defining factor is the exclusion of others. It was something that was imported from Europe along with anti-Semitism and racism and all the other isms we're trying to move forward from.
So Bannon is morally wrong, factually wrong, and strategically wrong, because those are different things.
Yeah,
strategically wrong as well.
Yeah, okay. At this point,
you have more faith than that.
I have more faith, and I also don't think it's worth my time to try and reason with white nationalists. I think it's worth my time to try and outnumber them.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I think that's the only strategy that works. Human nature hasn't changed that much, in 10 or 20 or 50,000 years. And, there are bad human impulses that exist that are still part of human nature. Silence is equivalent to acquiescence, I think, all too often. I think you'd have to confront extremist ideology. The fact is those folks are extreme and dangerous in their views, and they appeal to the worst instincts in human nature.
I think the civil rights movement is a good example. Nobody was silent. I mean, there was no silence. The issue was what happened when you were assaulted and attacked, and you just basically said, fine, you're going to come after me. If I'm going to go to jail, I'm going to go to jail, but I will not have my voice quieted, nor will I have my presence quieted. And I think it is going back to that kind of strategy that I think works. It isn't being against, it is being for somebody. I would rather see people saying we're not going to have Nazism, which I really worry about, and we should all be worried about the fact that you even have people joining it and becoming public about it. I think there has to be counter demonstrations that express more of our humanity, what is right. I don't want to react to people who are really, really hateful. I was very excited when I found out that Bannon was no longer in the White House, and I'll be even more excited when Trump gets impeached, to be blunt, but because they're purveyors of hate. But I think that you have to have another alternative, a group of people who are talking about the whole of us, and I'm going to be very less divisive. And I think that we have an incredible opportunity for whether they're elected officials, whether they are people from religious communities or the civic communities or the corporate community, to talk about what is best for our welfare as a whole. And it's they got to speak up and they've got to organize, but you need something to counter. I don't want the Nazis and the haters. I always say I don't want them to dictate the terms of the game nor its rules. The rules should be on our side, those of us that love this country and love its diversity and love its wholeness and love its welcoming attitude.
We've been talking about white supremacists in Charlottesville and in Seattle, and then there was the reaction to the white supremacy and slavery and theft of America's past. So that in Seattle, if you, for example, if you were thinking of taking a tourist friend to Bruce Lee's grave this weekend, that's not going to happen.
Hello. Thank you for calling Lakeview Cemetery. Due to the controversy over Confederate memorials, Lakeview Cemetery will be closed until Monday, August 21st at 9 a.m. We do apologize for any inconvenience this may cause. Thank you.
Lakeview Cemetery closed, not because of Bruce Lee, but because they have a monument to Confederate soldiers, not a Robert E. Lee, not a Stonewall Jackson, but a monument to Confederate soldiers that's been there for more than 90 years. And Lakeview doesn't want it to attract protests like the one we just saw in Charlottesville. This week, Seattle's mayor, Ed Murray, called for the removal of that monument and the removal of the statue of Vladimir Lenin in Fremont.
You know, that monument represents to many people in the city their families having been murdered, the destructions of tens of millions of people. If I were Eastern European American or a Jewish American, I'm not sure how I'd feel about that monument. So I think it's time for these things to go. They don't represent the best of who we are.
On KUOW's Facebook page, Cameron wrote, "Isn't the Lenin statue on private land? If it's on public land, it probably should come down. If it's on public, it's their right to display it." And Linda from Sammamish disagreed.
I've lived in this area for maybe about 32 years. And the first time I saw that statue, I was in beyond disbelief. It should most definitely come down. It's offensive. We can only wonder, well, would somebody put up a statue of Hitler and be happy with that? By golly, that statue needs to come down.
Okay, so a Confederate hero statue and a Vladimir Lenin statue in Fremont are not the same thing. The mayor called in practically the same breath this week for the removal of both. What do you think of those?
I think statements. I think that the Lenin statue should come down for the same reason the Robert E. Lee statues ought to come down where they exist. I mean, Lenin, they're not equivalent, and it's not really an issue of equivalency. We understand the Robert E. Lee story. A lot of Americans don't understand the role that Lenin played in the destruction of millions of people and the institution of one of the most oppressive and brutal regimes in our world's history. I think a lot of people look at it as kind of being kitschy, so it's okay. But I would like to hear from the people whose families or ancestors were killed by Lenin and Stalin and their comrades. On the issue of the cemetery, it seems to me it makes a difference that this is a monument erected on private property with private funds honoring the soldiers and not the commanders. If there's a difference to be drawn between people who were conscripted into serving and who died as soldiers and a difference from the leaders, I think it's worth at least discussing that. It is not on public land. It was not publicly funded. It's most people weren't even aware of it. But at the same time, I'm open to hearing other points of view and let's discuss it because Mary Murray has the public, who've been calling the cemetery and complaining about it, have raised it, and Mary Murray is elevating it further.
Okay, let's discuss it.
Well, I'm a Jewish American, and my family comes from what is now known as Moldova, and they were pushed out by a pogrom, so pre-Lenin, pre-First World War. When I saw the Lenin statue for the first time, I was kind of like, huh, but I immediately understood it as quirkiness. I think there's a very... If there was a statue of Stalin in Russia, I don't know, on the site of a former forced labor camp, I think that's more of an equivalent comparison. I mean, it's very different to compare the statue of Lenin in Fremont to Confederate memorials, which are honoring Americans who killed other Americans in order to preserve the institution of slavery, a practice of systematically dehumanizing people. So, yeah, I don't understand why we had to take down both, but if we have to take down the Lenin statue in order to take down more Confederate statues, so be it. I didn't care about that statue one way or another.
You know, it's interesting. When I first saw the Lenin statue, I said, oh, this is Fremont. This is supposed to be mocking Lenin. I mean, that's how I looked at it before. No one could take Lenin seriously. And then more because of other discussions, and particularly those with my sons, they actually think it needs to come down because they said, well, you dead? What if it was a Stalin statue? Now, it's very interesting that Putin now is erecting Stalin statues. But you look at Lenin, you look at Stalin, you don't find redeemable people. Right. And so it has caused me to really rethink. It's not just mocking. Maybe if it comes down, period, I don't need quirkiness in my life. There's enough other things to be quirky about. So, and prior to coming on the show, we had a wonderful conversation about that. I kept thinking, you just can't say it's quirky. It has to come down. But I want to talk about that cemetery as well. People assume that Seattle has been liberal. Seattle has not been liberal. This region, Washington State as a whole, we had brown shirts, and people don't want to acknowledge that in Oregon and in Washington. Celebration, in many respects, of Confederate soldiers was pretty typical of what was happening in the Northwest. It was a statement, and that endured for a really long time here. I mean, the civil rights movement here, I was a kid when Reverend Samuel B. McKinney decided to take on the entire city of Seattle over a whole series of in-place policies. If you look at the Seattle, if you go to the University of Washington and type in, they have a wonderful website that talks about race in Seattle and who conceived of where people should live. The North End would be open, the South End, how to get blacks, keep blacks out. There's on the historic, Seattle has a history page as well where they talk about how blacks couldn't get housing in my neighborhood where I live, how that was changed over time. So that cemetery is not like nice and neutral. It reflected a very deep value as to how Washingtonians felt about the Civil War and about Confederate soldiers. It was an endorsement. It wasn't neutral. I mean, they were making a statement when they decided to identify them as Confederate soldiers, not just soldiers. They could have said these are soldiers. No, they had to be Confederate soldiers. It was a statement of power and value in this city.
Are you calling on Lakeview Cemetery to remove the monument to Confederate soldiers from that graveyard?
I'm saying that the soldiers can be there if they're there, but I think that it is not a neutral statement, in my opinion. It's not neutral. It represents a period of time here that I would hope would be long gone and forgotten. I mean, Seattle sees itself as being really liberal. That is more current. I mean, there were some really rough times, even in my early childhood, about Seattle. I mean, when you look at the former city council member Sam Smith, when you looked at Reverend Samuel B. McKinney having to have police protection in this town in the 60s because of the opposition to their stances on civil rights. So I want that cemetery closed. It's a final chapter of saying we're no longer going to retreat back into, I always call our base divisive instincts, that we're looking at the whole and looking at the future. And so I think that Mayor Murray was correct. Both of them have to come down. We're better people than that.
Well, in a sense, we're talking about what monuments and statues are even for. So let's get to Washington State. Earlier this week, President Trump sarcastically said, "Who's next? George Washington?"
Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down statues to George Washington?
Obviously, we have one of those here right down the street from us on the UW campus, and we've been asking the mayor about this since he called for removing, in his words, statues and flags that represent this country's abhorrent history of slavery and oppression based on the color of people's skin. George Washington inherited slaves, bought slaves, owned slaves, conspired to keep slaves even though he was living in the North. This morning, Mayor Murray told KUOW he does not support removing the George Washington statue on the UW campus.
The Confederate statues represent people who rebelled against this nation. George Washington is a founder of one of the best democratic experiments in history. He also has an unfortunate and a terrible history of being a slave owner himself, although I think if you read the record, he was somewhat tortured about the issue. But I think, you know, then why don't we change the name of the state? I'm not sure that's the place we need to direct our energy.
I like the idea that we discussed in a previous show, about putting a plaque up that talks about Washington being a slave owner and about other aspects of his presidency and his character. I think that's a legitimate thing to do.
Well, Rob, you have a lot of standing, you know, a former attorney general in this state. And yes, we on KOW have been talking about a plaque for more than a year. I asked Jesse Jackson about this a year or two ago. What will you do about that? Will you call for a plaque to be put on that statue at the UW campus?
If there are enough people who would support it and help pay for it, I think that'd be a perfectly legitimate thing to do, to the extent that people are upset by the presence of the statue, given Washington's record as a slave owner as well as being a co-founder of the nation. I think that's a legitimate approach to take. It does probably more that's constructive in terms of spurring discussion and helping us remember our history. And I think Mayor Murray is right that, you know, you have to place Washington in the right context historically. You place him in the context of a time when slavery existed, and juxtapose that against the Civil War when we were trying to end slavery, not initially, of course, partway through the war, fortunately. And I think that's a valid as well. And of course, Washington statue at the UW is on public property. And I don't know if it was paid for with public funds. It may have been. I have to say a compliment Ron on his argument for removing the Confederate soldiers memorial in the cemetery, because that's the best argument I can think of. It is on private property. The cemetery is run by a nonprofit association. It was paid for with private funds. You know, it was by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. But here's something, Ron, I think is really interesting about that, the timing. There's been a lot of comment made about the fact that a number of the statues that are now coming down around the country of General Beauregard generally were erected in the 1920s. This monument was erected in the 1920s by the United Daughters of the Confederacy at a site which is the only burial place in the Northwest for Confederate soldiers, which it was established by the same group or similar group in 1911. So it's more complicated, but I think Ron is right that we need to be cognizant of our city's history, which is not the history we see today.
Plaque on the George Washington statue, anybody disagree with that?
Yeah, put a big plaque up on there. I mean, I grew up in suburban Philadelphia, and right where I grew up is a place called Valley Forge National Park. It's where George Washington stayed with his soldiers in the winter of 1776, and they offer historical tours, and big buses of people come through all the time. And there's this house where George and Martha Washington supposedly lived. You can travel throughout the entire house, and finally you get up to this top floor where there's a dirty mattress on the floor, and in very fine print, it tells you that George Washington had servants and, guests sometimes stay up there. I don't remember if slavery is explicitly mentioned, but I think it is heinous and irresponsible that it is not more prominently mentioned in this national park. I think we have a responsibility to remember our history accurately, including the awful, dehumanizing, genocidal parts of our history. And, in Europe, Europeans remember their history as well of the Holocaust, but they don't remember it by putting up statues to honor fallen Nazi soldiers. They celebrate Jewish cemeteries, and they have the names of the victims of the Holocaust in paving stones. And I think that if we want to remember our history, why not put up a statue of a civil rights leader, of a Black American, in place of these Confederate statues?
There could be a statue right next to the George Washington one. If a plaque is so non-controversial, now we're just talking about, what do we mean by plaque? I mean, you could put a Felix Bonnell, a historian, was telling us about ways of presenting statues where you have to even see the statue, you have to first confront a big presentation, and then you're looking at the statue through sort of a peephole. You know, you could be above the statue instead of below. The plaque could overwhelm the statue. Now we're just talking about, what do we mean by plaque? What do we mean by extra historical information on the statue?
I'm not too sure that if there are so many, there isn't any historical figure that I can think of that I could not write something about. I mean,
something shameful, you mean?
Yeah, they all have issues. George Washington had slaves. Thomas Jefferson had slaves and married one of them, or had common law relationship with one Sally Hennings.
Six children.
And so it's really interesting. When I look at them, I always say there was a group of people who decided to do something pretty dramatic, which is break away from a superpower. And they did. And they provided a foundation for a government and a country that's endured for a long time. I don't mind having saying that he owned slaves would not detract from the fact that you had people do some pretty extraordinary things in building this country and supporting it and creating it and risked everything to do it. And I don't want to detract from that. If somebody wants to note that he was a slave owner, that's fine. I don't think that would counter the monumental work they did. This country has evolved. I mean, you know, everybody talks about. I grew up when I was a kid. There were no laws to prohibit race discrimination. None. Zero. It was overt racism. I grew up in a community that had a sign that said, "Welcome to John Birch Country," and when you came in and said, "Thank you for visiting it," when you left. I remember my parents being called so many names, so often. I would not want that to be what Spokane is called or identified with, because it has matured and moved beyond it. So some parts of me want to say there's some things that are worth noting. I'm not too sure how much you want to note them. I think it's different when, in maybe this area. When I go to the southern United States, I don't mind it being mentioned because some of the underlying social systems and attitudes have not changed in hundreds of years, and they are embedded. And so even when I was working for the federal government, I came in, I had people who challenged my authority. You can't do that. And I would look and say, excuse me, I'm the deputy secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Development. The law is on my side. What do you mean I can't do it? And he said, well, you just can't. Because they couldn't get over an African-American having any authority. So in some of those states, lessons need to be taught, and others it needs to be understated. Maybe having the note understate something is maybe be important. I don't want to overstate somebody's what they did wrong. Now, I love Adams, because the Adams family were terrific, because they actually took a very high moral position and maintained it in their lives. You can see my ambivalence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind it being noted. I don't want it to detract from what I call something really fundamental, which is being courageous enough to tell another superpower to go get lost.
Let's make that the last word here. Ron Sims, former Deputy Secretary at Housing and Urban Development, former King County Executive. We're also here with Sidney Brownstone and Rob McKenna. And the Seattle mayor campaign took a turn. Race was also a part of that, as we'll hear. We'll tell you what happened there and more news of the week on The Week in Review. So stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with stranger reporter Sidney Brownstone, former state attorney general Rob McKenna, former King County executive Ron Sims. The campaign for Seattle mayor took a turn this week when candidate Nikita Oliver conceded defeat and did not endorse Carrie Moon. Oliver told me she'll vote for Carrie Moon. Isn't that an endorsement?
It is not an endorsement.
Okay.
That's my personal vote because I'm a voter. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the Seattle People's Party and my position as a formal mayoral candidate, I think it's really important that we acknowledge that it's actually politically expedient upon Carrie Moon or Jenny Durkin to approach myself and the People's Party and ask for our endorsement, and understand that in asking for that, there very much will likely be a counteroffer. You got to remember, we're playing chess here, not checkers.
Oliver wouldn't say specifically what her counteroffer would be. She said she would need to believe that Carrie Moon would restructure city government to make sure the most impacted people have political power. She said neither Moon nor Durkin are truly impacted by the city's most crucial decisions because they are, quote, wealthy white ladies. Ron Sims, you've endorsed Jenny Durkin. What do you think of Oliver's move and statement?
Well, I respect people's opinions. I disagree with her. That's why I'm supporting Jenny Durkin. When everybody else is remaining silent on the issue of the police relationships with particularly communities of color, she got up and sued them. As a U.S. attorney, she didn't have to do that, and she did. So, and you listen to her. I'm very, very comfortable with my support of Jenny Durkin. It doesn't mean that, and I mean, my issue is I want a city governed so that it's fair. And that's a skill. And that's why I supported Ms. Durkin. Rhetoric is so easy, and the idea of the moment is so easy. The issue is, how do you get into the bowels of a government to ensure that from bottom to top, it's on the same page you are in regards to value? And I think that she has that skill going in.
Sidney Brownstone, I think you endorsed Oliver, but you're supporting and are endorsing Moon in the general election. Is that right?
Yes. So in addition to being a reporter, this is a weird role. I'm also on the Stranger Election Control Board, or the SECB. So the SECB, as a body, endorsed Carrie Moon in the primary. And I don't think I'm saying anything radical by saying we're going to endorse Carrie Moon in the general. But I also wrote a dissent, and personally, I voted for Nikita. I think she embodied a lot of the struggles that people my age in the city are facing. She herself is a renter. And I think she was able to pull the discourse significantly left in the primary. And I hope that she continues to do so in the general with Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin.
Rob McKenna, now a Seattle voter. You've run a few elections. What did you think of Oliver's concession? And I won't say non-endorsement. She's just saying Carrie Moon needs to come to me and show that she is worthy of what I have. Because Nikita Oliver, we talked about this on this show, about that she has the support and passion and ground game, et cetera, from her supporters that Carrie Moon wants.
So her endorsement's worth something, Carrie Moon needs it in order to knit together enough votes to somehow defeat Jenny, who's in the driver's seat right now. And Nikita wants more than what Carrie is offering so far, which are compliments. She wants to know how Carrie is going to satisfy Nikita's agenda and her supporters' agenda. And that's a reasonable thing for her to do. It's the smart play, is not to give the endorsement too soon or too easily.
But why be so public about it? I mean, she's voting for Carrie Moon personally. She's very clear about that. But being so publicly skeptical that Carrie Moon cares about Nikita Oliver's supporters' issues, how significantly do you think it hurts Carrie Moon in the general that this is the conversation Nikita Oliver's having now?
It would help her more if Nikita endorsed her, but she has to give something to Nikita, and she might worry that that pulls her too far to the left in the view of people she's competing, whose vote she's competing with Jenny Durkin to obtain. So it's kind of tricky. On the one hand, you want all the non-Durkin voters to support you, but on the other hand, you know, Durkin's doing the same thing. So she has to, you know, typically what happens when you go from a primary to a general is you move from, you know, the edge closer to the center of the political bell curve, right? You're trying to pick up those centrist voters wherever that bell curve exists in a particular election. And that's what that's what Carrie needs to do now. So she's in a little bit of an awkward position. I think that Oliver probably undercut her own strategy, though, by saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to vote for her. I just won't endorse her. That was probably a tactical error if she really wants Carrie to move to her and her agenda.
I agree with you on the point that she probably undercut her by saying that she was personally going to vote for her, Rob, but I disagree with you on the point that Carrie needs to move center to get more votes. I think the thing that was so exciting about Nikita's campaign was that it had the opportunity, and maybe it didn't fully manifest this, to really engage people who hadn't been part of electoral politics before and register new voters. And I think there are many, many votes to be picked up on the left, but people who are running on centrist platforms aren't going to bring those people to the polls.
Well, I don't mean centrist. I think, but I'm just saying, typically what happens after a primary is you move closer to the center. And the reason that candidates do that is that they take their base vote for granted, figuring they got nowhere to go anywhere, assuming that the person they're running against is, you know, on the other side, right? So Bill Clinton moves closer to the center in the general election in order to beat George H.W. Bush. And this happened, Barack Obama, same thing. It's a typical strategy because you take your base for granted. You figure they got nowhere to go. They're not going to come over and vote for the Republican in the case of Obama-McCain race, for example. But I remember Ron Sims coming over and campaigning on the East Side, doing this very effectively, appealing to East Side voters and business people and even Republicans. Because he wanted to consolidate, he wanted to win, right, Ron? I mean, that's. I'm just saying, Sydney, this is typically what happens.
Sure, and I'm saying Seattle's kind of an atypical place because right now the left is split between Carrie Moon and Nikita Oliver, and I hope that Nikita's stance, whatever she's waiting out for, makes Carrie a stronger candidate.
Ron, you were just described as being a savvy pivoter.
No, I didn't pivot. I just...
I made that
word. No, seriously. I think...
use your own word.
No, I... we're San Francisco now, right? And I don't want to be San Francisco. San Francisco doesn't have populations of color because they moved to East Bay, because the East Bay elected officials listen to them. The tech industry now is migrating to the East Bay because they realize that people couldn't buy homes in San Francisco, but there was residential capacity on East Bay. Seattle prides itself at being San Francisco or wanting to be like that. And I want to say, wow, you look at the numbers and you're talking about a community that isn't, you can scream out loud all you want about how diverse they are. And I want to look, no, East Bay is diverse. And it comes down to what our self-image will be as to what we want to be in the long run. And it goes back to how you govern. And people dismiss it, but you have, you know, Seattle's not a small government. King County was twice as large, but Seattle's not a small government. It has a lot of authority. And the issue is, how do you get all those people sitting behind desks or sitting in offices to all of a sudden buy into the fact that you need to make change, but it has to be methodical. It has to be, people have to get used to working out of their silos and beginning to work with other departments so that you fashion a community that's able, that is not going to be the inevitable San Francisco, that it is going to be a place that welcomes diversity, doesn't lose diversity, is smart in how it provides opportunities for everyone. It's okay to have wealthy people. That's really great. But I just look right now and say, I don't see it in the rhetorical stances that people are taking, because when I was at HUD, we heard those rhetorical stances, but we also saw the results of those rhetorical stances. I want a community that is able to regain its diversity, and Seattle isn't. The next census data is really going to shock a lot of people about their self-image of Seattle.
Okay, a couple more things here. We're doing the Week in Review. I want to hit on a couple more topics, but let's stay on politics. Tonight, when the Seahawks play at CenturyLink Field, defensive lineman Michael Bennett's probably going to sit for the national anthem. He sat last week with a towel on his head. After the game, he said he's reacting to the violence and hatred in Virginia and to the competing demonstrations here in Seattle. And this is Bennett explaining himself to CNN.
I'm not protesting the flag. I'm actually trying to honor what we're supposed to be honoring, the freedom of America, the equality of America, the justice for all, and the liberty. Those are the things I'm trying to remind people that we all fought for, the forefathers. We said we would fight against terrorists, domestic and foreign. And right now, there's a whole bunch of domestic terrorism, domestic hate going on between your race, the gender, all this stuff going on because of somebody's the skin and color. So I want to bring up those issues and create those conversations and create and get people off their butt.
News Tribune sports columnist John McGrath told me that Bennett's silent statement is divisive and potentially distracting for his teammates.
Once you leave the locker room, Bill, and the time you spend on the field until you go back to the locker room, it's about a team. You have the rest of the season, the rest of the week, the rest of your life to promote social causes and what you find to be more important than football. But for 3.5 hours on Sunday afternoon, this sounds crass. There's nothing more important than football.
McGrath wrote a column telling Bennett to salute the flag or quit the team.
Can I just make a point here?
Yes.
He's sitting during the national anthem. It's not the Pledge of Allegiance. So this, Bennett's saying saluting the flag, McGrath's saying saluting. It's not what it's about. The national anthem is it is about the Star-Spangled Banner, all right? That's the theme of it. But I actually see a distinction between the anthem, which is about America generally, and about the Pledge of Allegiance, which is about the flag specifically. I don't know. Maybe that's mistaken. But I just thought it was interesting that they keep talking about it as if it's the Pledge of Allegiance. And to me, the difference is important because the national anthem is our nation's song, and we sing it together because we're singing it together. And I don't dispute Bennett's right to raise a lot of important issues about some things that are wrong in this country. And I hope he chooses a career in politics after football. I think his voice would be good. But this is a captive audience at a Seahawks game, and people are there to celebrate together their team, and he works for the team, and he's there to entertain the players. That's the best argument I've heard for why he should stand up. And you know, also the fact that standing up for the national anthem doesn't mean you don't think there need to be improvements in the country, but you still honor the country you've chosen to live in. And so that's
now it's like we're back talking about the what a statue means, because different people have different opinions about what it means to sit or stand during the national anthem.
What do you think, Ron?
His opponents know that he comes at them hard. I mean, let's get real here. He sits, then he puts on his helmet, and no one on the other side says he has slacked or pulled off or not supporting his team. The man wants to win. But I get so tired of people saying, I always call neutering African-American athletes. It's getting really old and frustrating. We have a right to make an opinion and have our opinion seen. He's not disrespecting the flag. Never has said he hates this country. Never has said that people who fought for this country are diminished in any way. He is making his statement about a social issue that he believes needs to be addressed. And actually, a lot of people are thinking about it now because he is sitting down and he is making his voice heard. So I think I couldn't have said it better. I couldn't have said it better. He is not disrespecting the flag. He's just making a social statement about something he feels about rather deeply. Mm-hmm. He's not an entertainer. He's a human being, an intelligent man with opinion who's in a peaceful protest.
Well, Rob, aren't you saying, Rob, that he is a professional entertainer? He works for the team, and it's part his job to, in that moment,
so this
is that
what
you're saying, to stand for the anthem?
So this is the other argument, and I think your point about neutering African-American athletes is really important, Ron, so I appreciate hearing that. The other side of the argument is this, that you know, you don't have a right to bring out your political views and demonstrate your political views when you're at work. And your employer doesn't have to tolerate it if they don't agree with it. That's the opposite point of view. And he is at work, and he is there and able to be there because fans spend a lot of money to buy tickets to be there. And I think that's the other side. What I'm just doing is echoing what I've been hearing in the discussions, on the radio about this for the last week.
Let me just add that his head coach, Pete Carroll, said that Carroll thinks people should stand, but that Bennett doesn't want to stand. That's okay with Pete Carroll.
And I don't think there should be any action taken against him as a player. That's for sure. But there is a view out there on the part of fans that I'm here because I'm excited about the team. It is a kind of entertainment. I don't mean to demean him by suggesting he's just an entertainer. He's not. And I think he should lead in the community and outside of the stadium. Every chance he gets should be talking about these issues because he has a certain kind of, if not authority, at least celebrity, that caused people to pay attention to him. If you've heard Bennett speak in person, as I have, he's pretty impressive and persuasive.
Sydney, do you have any opinions about this?
I personally can't imagine anything more patriotic than exercising your First Amendment rights before a football game when so many people are watching. I think that's a more meaningful display of patriotism than standing for an anthem that, I don't know, have you read the anthem lately? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. First of all, there are a lot of meaningless words in there. There's a reference, the original was a reference to slavery. The guy who wrote it owned slaves. I mean, I don't know. I would much rather. What's that Molly Ivins quote? Someone, wrap themselves in the Constitution and burn the flag than wrap themselves in the flag and burn the Constitution. I think Michael Bennett is perfectly within his rights as an American to sit down during the national anthem.
He is fulfilling his responsibility as a player. Opponents, I would not want to be on the other team knowing I have to block Michael Bennett. I mean, because he's going to put you on the seat of your pants, and you know it, right? And so teams have to scheme around him. And that's what is more important to me as a Seahawks fan. I want a person who I know when he gets down there, he is going to come at you play after play after play after play, because that's football.
Well, you're going to get football tonight at CenturyLink Field, and before that, someone might sit while someone's singing the national anthem and you are in your refrigerator looking for bean dip. That might actually happen tonight.
I'm going to the game tonight as it happens.
Oh, yeah?
And I'm going to start looking. I've never done this before. I'm going to look around the stadium to see if anyone else is sitting down. Or is it just Bennett or are there others? Because I certainly...
Yeah, actually, it's not one person. I'm guessing it's hundreds or possibly thousands of people sitting.
Possibly. It'll be interesting to see. But I don't see it as a test of patriotism. I do think there are times when it's appropriate to come together and celebrate what we agree on and not accentuate the differences in every single possibility. So that's just the other point of view. And Bennett's a very – I know Bennett because he comes to a charity fundraiser that I'm a big supporter of, and he's there every year. The guy gives back.
Rob, when they play – when you're at home, you're not at CenturyLink Field, and the national anthem is playing, are you standing – in attention with your hand on your heart, or are you looking for bean dip or sitting or something else?
I've never seen people at football parties that I've attended or hosted stand up when it's on TV. Because it's something we typically do when it's a live event. So I think that's kind of a straw man, actually, to say, well, you're not
it's the same
not
flag. It's the same song. Yeah, the Rockets are still glaring.
But the tradition is you do it when you're there in person. And I've been at stadiums around the country where people who are out in the aisles, people who are out in the concourse, can't even see the field, will stop and face in that direction. That's pretty impressive, actually.
I grew up, and I still do it now. I mean, I stand up and look at the flag and hold myself at attention, because that's my father was in the military and fought in World War II, and he didn't make it a career, but, you know, it was very clear that you stood up and did that. I think that Bennett, though, what I like about him is he's consistent on and off the field. His concern for other people is really, he does it when he doesn't have to do it. He's in that off season. He's doing some really amazing work. And I'm not going to look at him and say, you're not standing up, and have that define him. I want his life to define him. And he is doing some remarkable things in this community.
We've been talking about the week gone by here on this Friday in the Week in Review with Ron Sims and Rob McKenna and Sidney Brownstone. Anybody standing at attention while the moon passes between the Earth and the Sun on Monday?
I'll be rubbing my crystals to see if they do anything weird.
Yeah. See if they levitate.
Yeah.
My sister. I got my glasses ready.
Do you really?
Yeah. A friend of mine from the UW mailed me two pairs of eclipse watching glasses. So
really?
They look a little bit like those old 3D glasses you wear at the movie theaters, but the cardboard ones. So I'm hoping I don't come back to the next Week in Review blinded.
By the way, we got an email about this from a listener. Robin told us, and I'm now telling you, that Fred Meyer in Bremerton has approved eclipse glasses. Maybe call before you hop on that fast ferry, because people were trying to figure out, oh, I didn't plan for this. Are there any glasses yet? We also got a note from Shannon who says, please tell us how to create and use a pinhole box instead of only talking about the glasses, which can damage eyes. So, Shannon, there's a video on the homepage.
My wife has made a pinhole box.
Is that right?
Yeah, I made one in 1974 when I saw a full eclipse when I lived in Germany when Dad was stationed there.
And you still have it?
Show me how to use it so that I don't injure myself. Yeah. She's convinced if she doesn't, I will. But we're making a pinhole box.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I learned this week, don't try to watch the eclipse in Seattle from Puget Sound or even right near Puget Sound, because the temperature is going to drop so much when the sun is blotted out that it's going to create a bank of fog that's going to roll in off Puget Sound. She said, you know what would be cool? This UW expert said, go to the foothills so that you are up, so you're above the cloud bank and below the 90% eclipse, and enjoy that.
So you've just announced that all those places that we thought were going to be secret places to watch are going to be full of people now.
Full of joy and conviviality. You will be, Ron Sims, you're a hugger. You'll have plenty of people to hug during the emotion of the 95% eclipse.
KUW consistently keeps people informed.
Exactly. Thanks for this, everybody.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Bill.
Sidney Brownstone, Stranger reporter, and Ron Sims, former King County executive and HUD deputy secretary. Rob McKenna, former state attorney general in the state of Washington, still called Washington for now.
So far.
I enjoyed this conversation, everybody. Thanks a lot. And thank you for tuning in. Have a great weekend. Talk to you next week.